Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Taste Washington. With more than 235 wineries, 65 restaurants, and some of the nation's most talented chefs, Taste Washington is the ultimate taste test. Learn more at tastewashington.org.
This week on Meat and Three, we bring you stories about the coldest, darkest season. We start in a California vineyard.
It's cold, but it's wet, and things are still alive. There's a lot of life in this soil.
We explore two frontiers of cocktail culture, luxury ice and the rise of non-alcoholic drinks.
The rocks traditionally becomes 25% of your drink's volume, and as such, it imparts smells and tastes.
And we investigate the risks facing New York City delivery workers during the harsh winter.
In the wintertime, after 2 hours of biking, it's quite easy actually for the bikes to sing upside down or slips or slide.
Tune in to this week's episode of Meat and Three, that's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E, for some food for thought to sustain you through the dead of winter. Subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Good evening and welcome to Eating Matters, where we talk about food policy and how it impacts all of us. I'm your host, Jenna Liute, and we're broadcasting from Bushwick on Heritage Radio Network. One of the things I like best about this show is that I get to highlight the work of people involved in every aspect of our food system, from academics to politicians to authors, as well as founders of what I like to call good food companies. In other words, companies that are finding innovative and impactful ways to create a healthier and more sustainable food system. Which is why I'm pleased to welcome Adam Lowry and Dr. Neil Renninger to the show today, co-founders of Ripple Foods. Adam and Neil, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
And to have you in person, this is such a treat for me. Most of my guests usually call in, so it's wonderful to have faces to speak to.
It's great to be here.
Yeah, it's great that it worked out.
Okay, so let's just jump right in. What is Ripple Foods?
We are a plant-based food company focused on making alternative dairy products.
Okay, so that's very succinct.
Yeah.
Where were you started and when?
We started in the back half of 2014, and we're based out of Berkeley, California.
You're like, obviously.
I guess so. Yeah, it's true. When we first started, we were in my kitchen, and then
right.
We were in San Francisco, and
okay.
then we moved to Emeryville, and we got back this time last year. We moved to Berkeley.
So. All right,
moving on up.
Yeah, moving
exactly.
on up. Right, a long way from the kitchen. Okay, so what kind of products do you make then?
Yeah, so we make all kinds of dairy alternative products. So if you think about a soy milk or an almond milk, mm-hmm. we make an alternative to that, a plant-based milk. Ours is based primarily on peas, mm-hmm. but it also has other plant ingredients in it. And the real big difference is that unlike most of the products in this space, ours is actually nutritious. It's got things like protein, and it's rich and creamy and delicious. It's,
right.
The point is to make plant-based foods that are delicious for a more mainstream audience.
Okay. So peas like green peas?
Yeah, yellow.
Yellow, foods, okay,
yeah.
You're like yellow.
They're
kind of
like, like if you ever get a soup mix
yep.
and you see like lentils and peas in a soup mix, it's those yellow peas.
And then why those in particular?
They're a great source of protein.
Are you the engineer here, or the more of the?
I'm a little bit more of a technologist than Adam.
You saw
Adam,
me nod to him, didn't
yes,
you?
Yes. Yeah, you're like,
I'm passing that one.
Yes,
you know, Adam has an engineering degree as well, but
Who's got the culinary degree here?
Yeah, neither of us.
But that doesn't matter. It's delicious.
Thank you. So we use yellow peas because they're a great source of protein. You know, we wanted to replicate milk as best as we could from both from a nutrition standpoint and from a taste and mouthfeel, kind of that functionality standpoint. And the important part of that is to find the right protein. You know, milk is sugar, it's fat, it's protein kind of combined, and each of those has a function. The sugar is there for sweetness, the fat is there for kind of that creamy mouthfeel, the protein is there to kind of bind the water and the oil together.
Okay.
And just about any protein will do that equally well. But the problem with most plant proteins is they taste terrible, right?
Right.
They taste like the plant they're derived from, which is really kind of where we focused our initial work. How can we identify a way to clean plant proteins in a way that makes them easily usable in something like a milk?
So did that entail a lot of tasting, a lot of was a trial and error? We've got lots to talk about, but I want to start at the very beginning with kind of how this got started and the nitty gritty, especially. So were you guys just tried all the peas?
Well, yeah, but I want to ask you a question. Have you ever had pea protein before?
I have not.
Oh, okay.
I have not.
You should. You're in for a notch.
Am I going tonight?
You'll have our stuff, and it looks like we also have some things that we won't mention their brands, but some competitive product, and you'll get to experience the difference. But going back to your question, we kind of tried everything in the beginning, and actually Neil formulated the initial stuff, like you mentioned, in his kitchen.
Wow.
And the thing about plant proteins is they really don't taste very good, right? And so
what's an example of a plant protein? Another one.
Yeah, so I mentioned pea protein powder, which is if you go buy a protein powder in a GNC or something like that, and it's not dairy based, it's likely pea based. Okay. Another example would be soy protein isolate. And then there's all sorts of different things that you can get. There's
rice.
Yeah, rice protein is another big one. You can get flax protein.
Okay.
Hemp protein.
Yeah.
All of these types of things. And the thing that's really important to take away here is that what makes Ripple special is actually has nothing to do with peas whatsoever. Peas is sort of a means to an end for us as a protein source.
Mm-hmm.
All proteins are tasteless. They don't have any flavor. So if they're pure, they don't taste bad. They don't taste like anything at all. So there's actually no reason why a soy milk has to taste like soybeans and kind of be kind of beany, right?
Okay.
And there's no reason that a veggie burger has to taste all planty. And it was that was Neil's insight, actually. And if you get really pure protein, you can make really delicious plant-based foods that are really milky in our case, right? They're creamy, delicious, don't taste weird. They taste more like milk.
Right.
And then, you know, for us, what's motivating about that is then you open up your brand to a much larger audience than just people that are going to drink soy milk or almond milk because they can't drink anything else.
Right, because they have to. That's fascinating. And I just have one more question. I know I'm kind of stuck on this before we move on. But, you know, in terms of what does that process look like? How do you extract protein specifically in your kitchen? What does that look like?
Syringes.
Syringes.
Yeah, yeah. No.
Really, really tiny.
I was like, really? Yeah. I should.
I'm pulling your chain.
I should have prefaced this with the fact that I haven't had a science class in 20 years, and I'm pretty sure my last one was geology. So I'm a little bit behind the curve.
Yeah, no, I mean it's kind of simple. You have to soak the peas in water and kind of get the protein out of the peas and into the water. And then the problem is when you do that, you get a lot of other stuff along for the ride. So then it's about trying to play with things like temperature and pressure and pH and salt concentrations. And those things can tease apart the protein from the molecules that tend to give color and taste.
Okay.
And so once you do that, you can separate the protein from those taste molecules, and then you just have to isolate the protein.
And then that's what you guys have.
That's what we use.
That's what makes us unique. Yeah, we call that Riptine. You know, that's our made-up name for it, right? But Riptine really is, it's the purest plant protein anywhere in the world.
Okay.
And we can prove that, actually, analytically. The process that Neil and his team has created creates the purest plant protein that you can get, and it's virtually tasteless. And that's how we can put tons of protein in products and have them taste good.
Yep. And what do you mean by pure?
It is just protein.
It's not additives.
Yeah. Okay. So Neil could probably describe some of the small molecules that often make them taste weird. But
right. Things like flavonoids and tannins, things like that actually are usually the things that taste bitter or astringent.
Right.
Those are the things that we can take and strip away.
And they're not proteins, but they often bind to proteins. And that's why, you know, soy milk tastes like soybeans, not because it has protein. It's because of these things that Neil just mentioned that are kind of bound to the protein. And that's our secret sauce.
I'm like tannins, like wine.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And what do tannins taste like? They're bitter.
Bitter. Yeah. Exactly. Really astringent.
Yeah.
So you want to get those things away.
And if you add pea protein, you it's mouth drying, right? And a lot of that comes from not only tannins, but that too.
Okay, so you have Riptine, and that is like the main ingredient, or that's what all of your products are based on. How many different products do you have right now?
Yeah, we've got a couple of different lines. So we started with a line of non-dairy milks that are in varieties that you would expect, a regular and unsweetened chocolate and vanilla. We then extended into things like half and half, and which is great for coffee creaming as well as cooking.
Quote unquote, it's half and half.
It is a plant-based half and half.
Yes.
Yeah, I think we're going to get to that.
We're going to talk all about labels in a minute. Yeah.
And we just launched, we're super excited, we just launched a line of plant-based nutrition shakes and powders.
Okay.
So sports nutrition. Mm-hmm. So these are 20 grams in a 12-ounce bottle, very little sugar. And they're delicious. They're right here. And
yeah.
I haven't had
dinner yet.
Yeah.
So I think
it can be a meal replacement, although there's some yummy food nearby. So
yeah, I mean, yes. As everybody listening knows, we're broadcasting from Roberta's, which is the only pizza you ever really need to eat.
If you're, you know, we
do what we can here. we use our space. So also it's just completely true, as you guys will. We'll find out soon. Where does the name Ripple come from? That was one of the questions I first had.
Yeah, it's a play on the ripple effect. And you're probably going to get a slightly longer answer than you're looking for here.
No, I like it.
But like Neil and I believe that the food world just has way too many rules associated with it, that it's all about eat this, don't eat that, that's good for you, that's bad for you, and then it all changes and it's exhausting and confusing.
Yeah.
And you constantly feel guilty about what you are not doing well enough from a dietary perspective. And we want to turn that on its head and say, listen, we're all trying to get a little bit better every day. And just like pick one little thing that has a ripple effect, right?
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, maybe you try Meatless Mondays. And instead of being shamed for having a burger with your friends when you go out on Friday, like we want to be the brand that says good on you for, you know, doing that one little thing. And those ripple effects actually add up. So to kind of land this comment, we actually can keep track of how much water we save, how much carbon we save, how much more protein and less sugar people get. And the numbers are pretty astounding. So just in the last year, you're talking about over 100 billion gallons of water relative to what people could have bought instead of Ripple.
Right.
Talking about 20 million pounds of carbon, 500 tons more protein.
Versus like dairy?
Yeah.
Like animal versus, dairy?
Yeah. So
for like what is the comparison between?
Yeah. So So the 100 billion gallons of water is, if you were going to get that same amount of protein from almond milk through your regimen, you would consume 100 billion gallons more water, which is incidentally, that's the amount of water that LA uses in an entire year.
Really?
It's astounding. Right. Yeah.
That is an amazing statistic.
Yeah. And then the 20 million pounds of carbon. So for example, if you bought dairy instead of Ripple, that would emit the amount of Ripple that we sold in the last year.
Okay,
right?
Yeah.
That you would emit 20 million pounds more carbon. And so what we do is we actually communicate about this. We call it the Ripple Effect, right?
Uh-huh.
Hashtag. It's a hashtag. And on a periodic basis, we send it out.
Effect.
Yeah, you got it. And we send it out to our consumers because we want to give them the credit
right.
for the ripple effect that they're having. So mm-hmm. long answer, but that's why we call ourselves Ripple.
No, that's let's talk about the consumer. Let's talk about the consumer for a minute.
Yes.
Like, how have you found the response to be, like, it's in terms of to your product initially?
It's been amazing. And, you know, what we're trying to build a product that... you know, it's not just for vegans and vegetarians. It's
right.
for everyday people. Like, I want something that my grandparents would have drank if they were still yeah. around, right?
That's and really technically, important. You, if you're you, can make it in your kitchen, which is, you know, I want to, well, like, get back to how our grandparents used to cook and eat.
We're
like,
gonna
you're like, technically.
We're going to have to check the food safety of yeah. of Neil's
let's,
kitchen.
Let's not talk about yeah. that. No. It's just me and my kids, my poor kids, and they're still around.
There you go.
They still, you know, what's funny is they love these protein shakes. They drink them for dessert. Literally.
Yeah?
They
wow.
love them.
See them. They're like 12-year-old Arnold Schwarzenegger.
No, they're built like me, right? They're super skinny. They're tall and skinny.
So sorry I interrupted you.
No. But, you know, just to finish that story,
yeah.
they started obviously tasting milk from my kitchen and it wasn't good.
Mm-hmm.
And so they still, you know, Dad, thank you. Thank you for not making us drink that vegetable milk anymore. That stuff was so gross. It was so much better.
Yeah.
So there's never a better time to learn the response that you have to your product.
Mm-hmm.
As when you can no longer give it to people. So
yeah.
Unfortunately, we had a little hiccup this past year where we ran short on some product and some shelves got empty.
Mm-hmm.
And I have this buddy that's a friend of mine. He's kind of a neighbor and we're friends. And he told me the story. He was in the neighborhood grocery store. And he's in the grocery store and he sees this guy at the dairy alternative aisle. And he doesn't know the guy, but he sees him across there. And the guy just throws his head back and goes, Ripple, what are you doing to me?
that's amazing. You're like, we've made it.
Yeah,
as a company.
Yeah, I mean, you still want to not be out of stock.
You're like, still left some money on the table, but that's totally yeah. okay because you have the demand. But you, I mean, the other thing is that you guys are we're on the coast, right? So how are you, what are you doing to reach the middle of the people in the middle of the country
where, great, you know, distribution. I'm from?
Yeah.
You do?
Distribution's a big thing. So we intentionally distribute our products very much nationally. I mean, Target, Whole Foods, those are
Target.
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah. Target.
Were they one of your original retailers?
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah. They were the second place that we went. We were in some Whole Foods regions first, but Target mm-hmm. was our first national customer.
Wow.
Yeah.
And when was that?
That was in the summer of 2016.
Okay. So you have a focus in, you know, trying to reach everybody. Mm-hmm. And I should say a fellow Detroiter.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe even more of an incentive.
Yeah.
Want to get your product into your hands of people that you know. What was that like to kind of decide who you wanted to, or maybe it wasn't a decision. Did you... Like how you were able to initially get on people's shelves? Just like kind of take us back from, like, you know, you're a startup, you've got a young yeah. product. What does that look like?
Yeah, I mean, fortunately, it's not the first time I've tried to do this. So I started a company called Method Cleaning Products Company about 20 years ago, and all the customers are identical. So
right.
I've sold to Whole Foods. I've sold to Target before, a premium branded product.
I have bought your product in a Whole Foods.
Well, thank you very much.
I don't use it as much as I should,
okay.
which means I don't clean as much as I should. But
no judgments. We're not judging.
But I bought it. That's what matters. Right?
Ripple effect. One little thing. Yes. We're not judging.
If I decide to clean.
Yeah. So you know, Ripple is it's actually now the largest green cleaning company in the world. So
Method is. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Wow.
So Ripple.
That's, yeah.
I do that all the time. By the way. So. Those customers I had a pre-existing relationship with. And
okay.
then, of course, we've built out a team of salespeople and marketing people that have deep experience kind of selling to these channels and customers. And
mm-hmm.
that is by no means to say that it was easy
right.
Or has been easy. I mean, it's kind of a dogfight. But,
yeah.
But
to differentiate
you
yourself.
Build your business to try to do that. And then for us, without going into, you know, too much of a tangent, it's also we provide a lot of value for our retailers other than just – you know, kind of commodity products.
Right.
And so we play a strategic role for our retailers, and that helps too.
Okay. And you also have a company, a startup under your belt, right?
Yeah.
Is it a startup? Would you call it an established company now?
A startup anymore, right?
You have started up a company.
I've started up a company. A company called Amyris is a synthetic biology company. A company that was kind of mucking about with the genetics of yeast to turn, you know, yeast normally turns sugar into alcohol, right? That's beer brewing, that's wine making. We were engineering yeast to turn sugar into, you know, anti-malarial drugs and biofuels and renewable chemicals and surfactants and the like. Yeah.
That sounds difficult and important.
It was amazing. It was a super fun company, amazing people, amazing technology. Yeah. We took that company public in 2010 and they're still around and making great products.
And are you guys still involved, either of you, with the companies that you both founded?
No.
How did they
cut me loose.
They cut you loose.
Yeah.
They didn't want anything to do with me anymore.
after 15, 20 years.
Yeah, they were like,
that's it. Yeah.
Thanks, but
see you later. Got this now.
Yeah.
How did you two get to work together?
Well, our previous companies actually collaborated.
He mentioned surfactants.
Yeah.
Those are detergents. And
yes.
We bought that kind of stuff.
Okay.
And you know, what's funny is we were having a drink one night and I was kind of lamenting about the challenges in my business, which is really that we were primarily a B2B business. And I was saying, hey man, I'm so jealous of you. You get to sell straight to the consumer. I wish I had that advantage. Adam here. I don't know if you
want to. Yeah, I mean,
I'm like, careful what you wish for.
Exactly. Exactly. And I was sort of grass is greener in the other way, which was, you know, Neil had created a really proprietary killer technology that they were using as a platform that they could grow the business in lots of different ways.
Mm-hmm.
And that was not something that we had in my method days. And so I was like, man, I really wish I had a company that just had this like
the one
thing that you could monetize in a ton of different ways.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is we just like, yeah, whatever. And we just like had our drink. And then it was years later that this all kind of came together.
Yep.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yep. And that's what we're doing, right? It's, you know, we have both sets of problems now. We're developing technology and delivering it to consumers. Yeah.
Oh, that's so funny.
Yes. We definitely have double the problems.
You know what? Hey, so how do you guys decide what to create and when? What is that like, the product creation? Is that primary focus with the technology, or
it's really a collaboration? We have ideas that come in from our marketing team. Said, hey, like here is a place that we think is products that we think are really really viable in the market, and we should make something that fits those niches. And we have products that come in from our R&D team. You know, we give people what we call garage time, 10% of their time that they're supposed to work on passion projects
and
invent.
Yeah.
And we've got products that have, I mean, I think the shakes come actually,
both,
shakes were a garage time project initially, and they're great. And, you know, we've got examples of both that have come through.
All right, we're going to take a really quick commercial break to hear a word from our sponsors, but stay tuned for more.
This episode is brought to you by Taste Washington. A food and wine lover's wonderland, Taste Washington offers the most wine and food from one single place in one single place. Including samples from more than 35 wineries, 65 restaurants, 60 exhibitors, and some of the nation's most talented chefs. Each spring, attendees can drink and eat their heart out over 4 days brimming with specially curated events that highlight the best of Washington State. The result of a continued partnership between Visit Seattle and Washington State Wine, Taste Washington is taking place March 28th to 31st, 2019. Mark your calendar for this year's lineup featuring The Red and White Party, Taste Washington on the Farm, The New Vintage, Seminars, The Grand Tasting, and Sunday Brunch. Learn more at tastewashington.org.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Michael Harlan Turkel, and I'm the host of The Food Scene here on HRN. This show explores the intersection of food, art, and design by talking to people who are inspired by these ideas. The show features food photographers, food stylists, interior designers, and so much more. All the players that make the world so visually delicious. You can find The Food Scene wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
And we're back on Eating Matters, where today I'm speaking with Adam Lowry and Dr. Neil Renninger, co-founders of Ripple Foods. I want to get back to like the consumer, kind of educating consumers for a second, like, because that's a big part of any kind of big food or any good food company or startup. Yeah. Like, it requires a certain behavior change for a lot of people in this country. And that's like very challenging to kind of try and provide that education and do it in a way that is like engaging and also, you know, get people to kind of try your product specifically when they have that information. So what are ways that you guys work to kind of communicate your value add? Because there are a lot of them.
Yeah. So we really lead with the product, and we want the quality of what we put in the product to be the thing that really wows people, taste, the nutrition, that sort of thing. And so I'll actually kind of make an analogy back to my Method days, right? You know the brand. So you know that it's, you know, what most people know about Method is like cool shapes and pretty packaging, and it smells good, right?
Yeah.
But the deep sustainability of those products was, you know, really the core mission of that brand. And what the design did is it opened up the audience to people that were more than just people that were already buying green cleaning products.
Okay.
And that's very philosophical and important for Neil and I, because like, you don't only want to make green things for green people, because the vast majority of the market isn't that.
Yeah. You want to move the needle.
And you want to move the market.
Yeah.
And so if you then contrast that with the situation within the dairy alternative space, the consumer is moving plant-based. Mm-hmm. They want to eat more plant-based. And it's now not because they have to, it's because they want to. It's a lifestyle choice that they're making. It's not a dietary restriction.
Yeah.
And when that's the case, they're not going to be willing to sacrifice the things that they expect from fill in the blank, whatever product, in our case, dairy, right? And the fact of the matter is today, 90% of the products by market share that are sold in the dairy alternative milk category have little or no protein at all, right?
Yeah.
Almond milk has 1/8 the protein of milk. Coconut and cashew have none,
right?
Yeah. Our product has the same protein as milk. It gives you what you, and more importantly, it's creamy and rich the way that milk should be.
It tastes better. Okay, one thing about protein.
Yeah.
There's still a lot of debate. I mean, there's so much debate in the nutritional community about
everything.
I mean, protein, we're getting too much. Then I read an article like from Harvard Health that is like, I don't know, maybe we're not getting too much. Maybe it's fine. And so there's just so much back and forth. I certainly have always thought we have too much of a focus on at least meat based proteins. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering kind of obviously you have a product that has protein in it, so you're a little biased.
We're not a musclehead company. We're not trying to sell like, you know, Joe Weider 1850 weight gainer. You know, the staples in your diet should be nutritious.
Yeah.
Right. And everybody knows the primary nutritional benefit of milk is protein and calcium.
Calcium, yeah.
Right. And so your milk should have that. If it doesn't, it's really kind of just sugar water.
Right.
And so what's kind of the point of those empty calories?
Yep. Well, yeah. Cause I read that, you know, one of the things, the goal of your company is to fix a big gap in the nutrition system. And so one of my questions to you is going to be like, what is that gap? And we've talked a lot about protein. And so, while there is some debate in the community, I'm just kind of wondering where you fall.
Yeah. It's the safest place for your calories. Adam, you mentioned
protein in general.
Okay. Adam mentioned it's about the quality of the calories you're putting in your body.
Mm-hmm.
Despite people's movement towards things like coconut milk and coconut fat.
Yeah.
Like, again,
that drives me crazy, by the way.
It drives us crazy as well.
It's so
saturated
stupid.
Fat is not healthy for you. It is well established.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if it's coming from a plant. It's not healthy for you. Yeah.
But what if it's grass fed?
Oh, man.
Sorry.
Holy cow.
I'm going a little off I'm going a little off kilter.
That's okay. I like it because there are these trends that drive me crazy.
Yes. Grass-fed coconuts?
Yeah, grass-fed coconuts are the worst. Like, will you stop with grass-fed coconuts, people?
Yeah, exactly.
No, but, yes.
Yeah, so, you know, we're looking for fats that are very healthy to put in our product, but also, the primary calories are coming from the protein.
And we kind of look at it from a broader macro standpoint from nutrition. I mean, while there is this debate on protein and things, mm-hmm. the health issues that are out there have to do with diabetes and heart disease,
right.
broadly mm-hmm. speaking, right? And a third of people in the country have high cholesterol, right?
Yeah.
And the plant-based world doesn't have any cholesterol in it, right? So none of our products have any cholesterol. They're very low in saturated fat.
Yeah.
They're much lower in sugar than their dairy counterparts, right?
Which is so important.
That's like the macro stuff that's really important. And then, as Neil said, if you're gonna have this as a part of your dietary staple, like it should provide nutrition. And so that's why we put the same amount of protein as milk. That's why we do. I mean, we could put twice as much if we wanted, but we don't.
Right. So how did you decide? Why was it just? Is that like a flavor thing? You know, like the same amount of milk.
The protein.
Yeah.
No, we wanted to replicate milk.
Okay. Right? Okay.
It really was like what does milk have? It has 8 grams. All right. Yeah. That's what we're doing. Right.
Like.
It's
that simple.
I
wouldn't say it's not broke, but it's like this is what you know. That's the standard.
It's the standard, and also, I mean, if you think about it. We mentioned the protein part, but the other part about dairy alternatives is that most people consider them kind of thin and watery and a little bit chalky. So, like, you have this crazy irony, which is that most dairy alternatives are actually awful alternatives to dairy.
Right. You're right? Like, it should not be.
And so for us, that was kind of a design principle, which is like, well, we want to make a dairy alternative that's a great alternative to dairy. It should have the same nutrition or better.
Yeah.
Right? It's got more calcium and the saturated fat and all that. And it's just as tasty and creamy and like it works in your coffee, it doesn't separate and like kind of all that stuff.
And what is the sugar? How much sugar? Is the sugar all added in the sense that there's nothing like it's just pure protein? So obviously everything is going to be
added
in terms of product formulation.
Right. So it is added sugar. It has actually half the sugar of a dairy milk, our original formula.
People don't realize how much sugar
there
is in dairy.
There is a ton of sugar in dairy. And because it's plant-based, we can actually add half of that amount of sugar, and it actually is still sweeter than normal dairy milk. We also have an unsweetened variety. We have actually two unsweetened SKUs, one that's kind of unsweetened original. It's kind of a playoff of our original milk. And then one that's unsweetened vanilla flavored. We don't have them here, but those have zero.
Okay.
No sugar whatsoever.
Yeah. And they still taste good?
They still taste good.
Because they don't have all that. And the trick there is the protein, right? Yeah. You're not covering up a weird protein taste.
Yep.
Yeah.
So you can get away with it.
And certainly the calcium. I mean, this is something, it always... it's astounding to me, kind of the big dairy's like hold on the market. I mean, overall, basically, but this is no, clearer the case, I think, with the National School Meals Program, where 30 million kids are fed every single day through this program. And in order for schools to be reimbursed for like free reduced lunch, like they have to have three components on their tray. One of those components is milk,
right.
As in a cup of
milk
fluid. Animal milk.
Yes.
It just like blows my mind. But there's a huge, and maybe that can be Ripple one day.
Man, I hope so.
That would be really amazing.
If you can tell us how to crack that nut, I'd appreciate it.
Yes, institutional purchasing. So important. Yeah. No, so, but it's, but all of the dietitians, there's so many dietitians who are like, we cannot get rid of milk because it's the primary source of calcium for these kids. I mean,
it doesn't need to be. Right,
yeah.
Exactly. There are plenty of other sources of calcium, vitamin D as well, right?
Right. And so yours are similar, same thing.
Same thing, yeah. We have more calcium than a glass of dairy milk. We have slightly more vitamin D than a glass of dairy milk.
Mm-hmm.
And then we, you know, from a fat standpoint, we actually have omega-3 fatty acids in our fat profile just to add more nutrition.
Okay.
Yeah.
What is the price point like for your products?
Yeah, we're kind of what you'd expect to pay for a non-dairy milk. So we're about the same price as the almond milks and soy milks that are in the marketplace. So basically, a large bottle of our stuff, you'd get it for between $4 and $5.
Okay. I should probably talk about price. And I know I'm all over the place right now, but I'm just I have so many questions about this.
Yes, absolutely.
Let's talk about just the size of the market in general, which is something I kind of wanted to do at the top. So how big is the plant-based dairy alternative market compared to animal?
It's about a $2 billion market in the U.S. Okay. Conventional dairy is about $20 billion. So it's about one-tenth of the size and those are the milk stats, right? Dairy industry, including all the dairy
products
is even larger than that.
But it's important to recognize the dairy alternative space is growing really fast,
right.
And the dairy space is actually declining slowly.
Right. I mean, in terms of overall milk consumption in this country, which I always find surprising, but certainly, certainly milk is really cheap right now, and dairy farmers are in a really bad way. So kind of with that in mind, I think that there's, I think about the landscape and the trade associations, and I feel like with the rise of plant-based milk, dairy products, I imagine big dairy is probably not so psyched to have a competitor come in that is gaining steam, not just like with your company, but just in the, as a category in general. So how have you, has that been an issue for you guys yet, or are you kind of not there yet?
No, it's been interesting. You have big dairy that's trying to redefine what we call milk.
Right.
You have legislation that's gone in at a national level and even in some states that's trying to change the standard of identity of milk
And what they want to change it to is just flat out awesome, right?
Yeah.
They want it to be, and I believe the quote is, a lacteal secretion from a hoofed mammal.
Really?
Which is, if that's what milk is,
you're like, I do not want to be
milk.
So, yeah. So just a bit.
Because,
I mean, it's accurate. It's accurate. So standard of identity is the official designation by the FDA, right? In terms of like what it actually is defined as.
Right.
And there's been a big movement from the dairy industry to define milk as only from an animal.
A hoofed mammal. Yes.
A hoofed, and lactating.
A lactating hoofed.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. And even more than that, obviously there's soy milk and almond milk, and there's been case law that has been that's gone through the courts in cases that they say, hey, yes, you can call something soy milk because nobody's going to mistake the
They're
not going to be misled by calling it soy milk because it's obviously, if it's soy milk, it's coming from a soybean.
Right.
And there's nobody in the dairy alternative space, at least that I know of, that uses the term milk unqualified.
Right.
Meaning just says, hey, this is milk.
Yeah,
it's always soy milk or plant milk or something.
Or if you're in Brooklyn, oat milk.
Tiger nuts.
So the Ninth Court just upheld the dismissal for the class action, saying that it was against Almond Breeze, right? Which they're almond milk. I mean, it's kind of like your competitor / comrade.
My
view of almond milk isn't that great.
Right. Yes. Right.
I mean,
but a win for the overall industry.
A win for the industry. There is a piece that of the dairy industry's argument that we understand, and that is the fact that all of these, you want something that has that same nutrition.
Right.
And a lot of 90% of the market doesn't.
Yeah.
We get it.
We would absolutely support somebody saying, hey, well, in order to be able to use the term milk, it's got to have the nutrition of milk or better.
Yeah.
Totally. We'd be on that because that's what our company philosophy is. And 90% of the products sold in this space are pale in comparison from a nutritional standpoint. So I think Neil's right there. And we actually sent a letter to Commissioner Gottlieb, the FDA lead. We didn't hear back, which
what did you say in your letter?
Basically that. We said, listen, we hear you're thinking about, defining more tightly how you can use the term milk. Like,
Yeah.
Totally understand why you're doing that. And just so you know, not all non-dairy milks are deficient in this nutrition. And just so, like, just be aware.
Yeah.
Right.
And the FDA is like, sorry, nobody's home because the government's shut down.
Yeah.
I'm sure they were. They're not working. I'm sure they were when you were sent that letter. But, you know, so where is that? Where, I mean, is there, that was something that the FDA was looking at in terms of changing the standard in 2018, but has that moved at all?
No. Still? No. It's still under consideration. And you know, we have a trade group called the Plant-Based Foods Association that that's helping organize and
is that Michelle Simon?
It's Michelle's group.
Yep, yeah,
exactly right. And she's doing a great job leading that group and making sure that we're all aligned and kind of, you know, keeping track of where that stands and not only at the national level, but also at the state level.
State level,
yeah. Because there are some states that are cropping up with similar language.
What do you think the next kind of regulatory fight or, you know, attention that will call your attention will be coming from? Or do you think it's labeling primarily for the next year or so?
Yeah, I think it's labeling. I mean, we're going to have to make a change to our labels to add added sugar to the nutrition facts portion,
which will
label.
Be true of everybody in the non-dairy space.
It will be.
Yeah.
You know, that'll be the next bit. I, you know, it's that piece. It's a hard one.
To read the tea leaves.
Well, it's a hard one to read the tea leaves. I think, you know, specifically around the concept of added sugar, putting added sugar on a label. It's hard for us to. Well, we're gonna have to put it on the label.
Yeah.
You know, dairy milk still has double the sugar that we do.
Yeah.
And it's gonna have zero added sugar.
Right. I was gonna say it's gonna yeah. So
but,
that's gonna
but sugar,
be
sugar, you know,
sugar.
Yeah. Hence the, you know, but and then it gets back to like educating consumers.
Correct.
But this is a very nuanced.
Yeah. The thing, crystal ball your question. I don't have one, but I think the thing I think is sort of could be weird is that it seems like some people are trying to play this on a state by state basis.
Yeah.
Which makes it really sort of insidious in terms of its impact.
Mm-hmm. Where, I mean, that's how federal legislation gets passed. You have to get a number of states on board first, and then it's like
But then it's a patchwork, and there's all these sort of different.
It's a nightmare for a while.
Yeah, and it's hard for a small company like ours to, I mean, even to keep track of it. You know, I met with some people in Washington D.C. that were like part of talking to the FDA, and like the price tag to even just write a letter is like our marketing budget for a year. It's like, you know, it's like,
really?
It's not quite that bad, it's a huge amount of money. If you wanted to play in that game, it's just not, I mean, that's why trade associations kind of exist,
right?
Because it just, you just
have to,
it's just money.
Right.
It's literally just money.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know why that surprised me for a second.
Yeah.
I can still be
sad,
surprised.
But
yes.
True.
It is sad.
So it's hard to read the tea leaves, but, you know, it's good to, I feel like you guys have your work cut out for you, at least for now.
We feel that way too.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah. You're like, we've got enough for right now just
to
focus
exactly
on.
Right.
We are going to have to wrap up in a little bit, but I still, would be remiss if I didn't ask a question about farmers and your suppliers.
Yeah.
Who do you guys work with? Like, what does that process look like? Where, you know, is it grown in the U.S.? How much are you sourcing, kind of generally speaking?
Yep.
Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
So peas, our peas are grown in the U.S., U.S. and Canada. So
we'll accept Canada. We like them.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. They're buddies, at least now, I think.
They have health care.
They have that.
You're looking at the Dakotas, Montana, up into Saskatchewan, right? Kind of northern plains regions.
Mm-hmm.
We source our peas in a couple of different ways. We work with specific farmers, and we source other peas through to kind of conventional
aggregated supplies.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. What's nice about, maybe a little bit more about the why the peas are super sustainable, right?
Yeah.
You're looking at a crop that doesn't require a lot of water to grow. A lot of these things, these farmers actually dry irrigate their pea crop, so it's just rain irrigated.
Really?
Yes. And
is there a lot of rain in the Dakotas?
No, but they don't need a lot. Peas don't need a lot of water.
Wow.
Yeah.
They also grow in a slightly rainier season on the shoulders.
Yeah. It's actually, you don't want too much water. Like, the reason why they don't grow further south is because it's too wet.
Wow.
So
it's perfect for global warming.
It is. They are a great crop.
We're going to have a lot of that.
You know, they're nitrogen fixers as well. So, like, they're an amazing crop.
So you don't have to fertilize. You don't have to put nitrogen fertilizer on them at all.
Yep. Wow.
So, you know, they're already just a super sustainable crop. But, but we get to actually identify farmers that are even kind of pushing the edge, the people that actually don't till their land when they're farming, which is a huge contributor of greenhouse gas emissions. But there are plenty of folks out there that are pushing the edge. They realize that tilling actually declines their soil quality. So they actually farm with a no-till practice. And, you know, those are farmers that we love to work with.
Yeah. And how do you select your farmers?
How have we identified them?
Yeah, how have you found them?
We have an investor that has actually helped us, an investor that is kind of integrated from, you know, they invest in everything from land to companies like us, right, who are delivering CPG companies.
Across the value chain of ag.
Yeah, exactly. So they've helped us identify some of these farmers in the regions that they know very well.
Right, and make those connections.
Yep.
All right, well, a couple more questions before we have to wrap up, but I'm curious, as two people who come from like non-food companies, right, that you started, what have you found? I want to ask each of you this, like, challenges, what is different about working in this space compared to...
Well, for me, there's a lot.
A lot, I mean, yeah.
How much time do we have? I mean,
well, you guys were so perfectly succinct in the first question. We make up for it in the back end.
There's so much learning, which is actually the most entertaining part of starting a company. It's all the little pieces that you don't know about, working in a space that you find out. Things to me are things like, there are lots of little frustrations. Our brokers are great. Our brokers help, are kind of an extended sales staff. They do a great job. It blew my mind that there existed this kind of layer of people that, you know, you have to pay in order to get your product on the shelves. And, and that means is, you know, you're paying them, you know, if you're paying them 15 cents a bottle, that's 15 cents a bottle the less that you're getting.
Yeah.
Those things, there are lots of little things that add up.
Like the distributor.
Yes,
a
distribution partner. You know the cost of moving product, the freight costs,
perishables.
Yes, all of those things.
Is your product shelf stable? Like not shelf stable, but you where
some,
is it
some
found?
Are some aren't. So our core milk range requires refrigeration, but our protein shakes don't.
These guys
for
don't.
Example,
okay. Yeah. That makes sense. Yep. So so quite a bit that's different from.
Oh yes.
I don't even know how to summarize the company that you founded. again, we go back to my lack of science background, but I'm fascinated by it.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
What about you?
I think I would have thought that the manufacturing environment in the food world is very. Food safety is a huge issue, and so you've got to be all over that.
Yeah.
And I was surprised how consolidated the manufacturing infrastructure was, meaning there just aren't that many people that actually do this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a big surprise for me.
So like the production, where you're...
Yeah,
food...
turning our ingredients into our products.
Yeah. And where do you mostly produce? Is it in California?
We have facilities in California, but also across the country and actually into Southern Canada,
wow.
depending on the product.
Yeah. All right. Well, what's next for you guys?
2019, start of a new year.
World
What's the
domination.
Plan? I like that.
Where do you start?
More products. Obviously, we just released the nutritionals line, and that your listeners can find at Target stores.
Yeah,
they can also find our Barista Series milk at Target
wow.
stores, and that product actually will blow your mind.
Yeah,
because it. You talk about that performance of that velvety sort of latte foam that you get from dairy.
So that's a barista. Is it milk or is it like a half and half?
It's milk.
Okay.
It's a milk, you know, it's for like making a latte.
Okay.
And we also have a half and half, which is great as a coffee creamer.
That's what I do.
Yeah.
I'm a half and half girl.
Yeah. Yeah. and then, yeah, we're going to be, the vision for Ripple is to build it into a brand that's all the way across the dairy regimen. So think about a couple of years from now, milk, yogurt, cheese, ice cream, the
right.
works.
I eat and, a lot of those.
Yeah, and we're going to be stepping into some of those new areas in 2019, so keep your eyes peeled.
That's so exciting.
Yeah.
All right, and so Target and Whole Foods, any other major retailers?
We're in most of the major grocers across the country. Those are, of course, different names depending on where you're listening from.
Right.
But yeah.
For our Detroiters.
In Detroit, I know you can buy some of our products at Kroger stores.
There you go, Kroger.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
It's a big one.
I've totally forgotten what the major grocers are.
I feel
are
like
in Detroit.
Kroger is the one.
Yeah, that's
pretty much the one. That's the only one that comes to mind in terms of like major. But yes, all right. Well, plenty of options for sure. And I just want to thank you both so much for coming on the show and joining me in the studio.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for having us.
I want to give a big thanks to our sponsors for their generous support of this program. Show music is by Tim Archer. All episodes of Eating Matters are available on the Heritage Radio Network website or as a podcast wherever they're found. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe and leave me a comment. Let me know what you think. I'm Jenna Liu, and thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org, or connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage, and thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.